This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, February the 20th, 2002. I'm Nell Abram. President Bush visits the demilitarized zone separating North and South Korea. We'll have a report from the DMZ. The Supreme Court hears arguments in two cases today. On trial, the death penalty and school vouchers. And mandated U.S. citizenship for baggage screeners draws protests across the West Coast. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Israeli bombs hit a UN-run school in the Gaza Strip last night, causing extensive damage. The school is located next to Palestinian police headquarters in the occupied territory. An F-16 missile struck a police building and exploded, scattering deadly debris over an open play area. A second missile missed the police compound and hit the roof of a classroom but did not explode. On a visit to the school this morning, Peter Hansen, head of the UN agency assisting Palestinian refugees, demanded assurances from the Israeli government that no more attacks would occur near UN installations. Inigo Gilmore has more on the Israeli offensive from Jerusalem.
Launching attacks by air, land, and sea, Israel retaliated today against Palestinians for an ambush on a West Bank outpost in which six Israeli soldiers were killed. Yasser Arafat's official compound in Gaza City was hit, killing at least four members of his elite guard. Tuesday night's ambush was the most lethal attack on Israeli soldiers in the West Bank in more than 16 months of fighting, and the Israeli authorities have promised a ferocious response. The latest spasm of bloodshed has given voice to Israelis who have begun calling on Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to abandon his refusal to negotiate with Palestinian leaders while violence continues. Other Israelis counter that such demands provide aid and comfort to the enemy. At the moment, the two sides seem to agree on only one thing, that the killings will continue. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Inigo Gilmore in Jerusalem.
A U.S. appeals court has invalidated FCC limits on media ownership. Gareth Schweitzer reports from D.C.
The decision paves the way for media conglomerates to further expand their market share. Companies such as AOL, Time Warner, Viacom, and the News Corporation will likely see restrictions on the number of stations they can own reduced or removed entirely. The current Federal Communications Commission chairman, Michael Powell, has already questioned the need for such restrictions. Janine Jackson of FAIR, a media watch group, notes that it will become increasingly difficult to report accurately on big businesses who also control a large percentage of the broadcast outlets.
Obviously, it's harder to report critically on an owner that now owns your station as well. So we've seen that concentration has always led to a sort of dumbing down and a sort of blanding out of media content, less critical coverage, and I think this is only going to make things worse.
Local broadcast stations are highly attractive to larger companies as they are among the most profitable businesses in the media field. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
Italian police raided the Indy Media Center in Bologna this morning with a judge's warrant in hand. According to one legal representative in Genoa, they took film, audio equipment, and tape from the center. He said the lead prosecutor in Genoa was looking for any tape from the G8 demonstrations that took place in Genoa last summer. According to a press release issued by the Italy Indy Media Center, police have seized the tools used daily by hundreds of Italian activists. And activists in 50 U.S. cities, including D.C., Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York, are orchestrating a protest against a company they call the world's most destructive bank, Citibank. Miranda Kennedy explains from New York.
This week, students in 50 different cities across the country are demonstrating against Citibank, the largest financial institution in the world and the largest funder of the fossil fuel industry. The Rainforest Action Network initiated a week of action against the financial giant's involvement with the controversial Camisea gas project in the Peruvian Amazon. According to a study by the Smithsonian Institute, the Camisea project will affect one of the world's most biologically diverse regions. Citigroup has also partnered with Enron in the contested Dabhol power plant in India. With hundreds of demonstrations, a boycott of Citibank credit cards, and nonviolent direct actions outside Citibank branches, activists have mounted an ongoing campaign to pressure the bank to ban funding for environmentally destructive projects. They call Citibank the world's most destructive bank. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miranda Kennedy in New York.
Finally, Lori Berenson's request for a pardon has been denied by Peru's President Alejandro Toledo. And a U.S. State Department spokesperson in D.C. said the United States believes Berenson received due process. Lori Berenson is serving 20 years in a Peruvian jail, convicted of conspiring with leftists to overthrow the government. She's now on a hunger strike protesting the treatment of all Peruvian prisoners. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush toured the demilitarized zone separating North and South Korea today. He reiterated his belief that North Korea is evil, but said the United States has no intentions to invade the nation. However, he also said North Korea must demonstrate it does not intend to threaten its southern neighbor, or the U.S. will honor its commitment to defend South Korea. Alan Lefkovich files this report from the Korean DMZ.
Nobody can pass this point. Here it's the demilitarized zone just north of the 38 parallel, where George W. Bush decided to go today.
They have a peace museum there, and the axes that were used to slaughter two U.S. soldiers are in the peace museum. No wonder I think they're evil.
But the American president did not see the thousands of elderly South Koreans who each year come to the border to see the land of their ancestors before dying. Gary Rector has been a Korean citizen since he left the American army 20 years ago. One day, he was in this DMZ.
Many of them who live in the South, who have ancestral graves in the North, will on the day of, say, an ancestor's death, the day that they would normally carry out a certain ritual, they will go up as close as they can go to the border, look across with longing and perhaps a few tears in their eyes.
Those people want to know what happens on the other side of the border. Since the end of the Civil War and the separation of the country into two parts, the North and the South haven't made any informational or cultural exchanges. North Korea is probably the last wholly isolated country in the world, but the South Korean people still want to help their brothers, explained Gary Rector. But the North Korean people don't know that.
The packages are relabeled so that the people who receive them won't know that they come from the South. So I really don't think that, the people's attitude towards South Korea will be determined by whether we actually send aid or not. It will be determined by how the North Korean government presents that aid to its people.
And help is what everyone needs in the North. In the last 8 years, around 1.5 million people died from starvation. Young Suk is a young student in Seoul. He wants to help the North Korean in their fight against this starvation.
When you're hungry and starving, when you're young, when you're a child, it gives you a permanent damage in your brain. And so the trauma will be permanent. If we don't, help North Koreans, the anti-sentiment toward South Koreans will be strong. The wider the gap is, the harder the feeling the gap is, I think.
But for the moment, the information that comes from the North is very thin. That is why in the South, people develop their own vision of the North. Gary Rector and Young Suk have their own phantasm about the North Koreans.
They had been brainwashed, and I and my generation had been brainwashed too. When I was young, when I was attending elementary school, you were taught they came to Korea, they sneaked in and they killed Isumbo, the young child. But now many people doubt Isumbo ever existed. And when we were young, we were taught that the North Koreans look like monsters.
Some monsters well known to Mr. Jun. He was one of the thousands of political prisoners in the unhuman camp of Kim Il-sung. I met him in Seoul just a few days after he arrived in the South.
이제 한국으로 오게 된 거죠.
The guards at the prison camp are treated better than, they have more benefits than the ordinary soldiers. And the life of the guard and the prisoners in the prison camp is just on the opposite extremes. Prisoner, once they're in, they are treated less than beasts. They're not human beings. You can't freely talk. You can't act freely. And most of the time, the prisoners try to avoid eye contact with the guards and just avoid them in general so that they wouldn't provoke them to more violence.
Just like the relationship between the American and the South Korean people in a way. But today it is against a country full of prisoners and starving people that George W. Bush followed his crusade. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Alan Lefkovich in Seoul.
The state of Virginia fought in the U.S. Supreme Court this afternoon to keep its right to execute mentally retarded capital offenders. The court ruled 13 years ago it couldn't ban the practice because there was no national consensus that such executions are cruel. Virginia argues that in spite of increasing support for a ban on capital punishment for the mentally retarded, it's still too soon to abolish the death penalty in these cases. Joshua Chaffin reports from the Supreme Court.
Virginia death row inmate Daryl Renard Atkins was convicted in the shooting death of 21-year-old airman Eric Nesbitt in 1998. Prison doctors estimate his IQ at 59, giving him the cognitive ability of a child between 9 and 12 years old. His lawyers say Atkins did not understand the criminal nature of his conduct, and as such, the state should not be allowed to execute him. Atkins' lawyer James Ellis told the Supreme Court that all mentally retarded criminals face the same situation. They lack sufficient culpability for their actions because they don't have an adequate understanding of the consequences. Lawyer Ellis says Atkins should be subject to life without parole, but that just as children are not eligible for the death penalty, neither should be the mentally retarded. But the state of Virginia says some mentally retarded criminals do understand that they'll be punished for what they do wrong, and that the death penalty should remain one of the possible punishments. The state of Virginia's lawyer, Pamela Rumps, told the Supreme Court the decision should be left to juries. Both sides refused comment outside the Supreme Court. The court was mostly interested in what the majority of Americans think. Justice David Souter described the Eighth Amendment, which bars cruel and unusual punishment, as an evolutionary process which changes with the popular mood. Daryl Atkins' lawyer told the court, Americans are showing through their state legislatures that they don't want mentally retarded offenders executed anymore. It's been 13 years since the court last considered this question. At that time, only two states had laws specifically prohibiting capital punishment for the mentally retarded.
But today there are 18 states. In fact, most of these states have adopted these laws in the last several years. And there are only 38 states that allow the death penalty at all, so that means there are only 20 states out of the 50 that allow executing the mentally retarded.
Virginia Democratic State Senator John Edwards does not oppose the death penalty, but he does oppose executing the mentally retarded. Edwards wrote a bill to ban the practice.
And just a couple weeks ago, the Virginia Senate passed my bill 40-0, unanimous, to abolish the death penalty for the retarded. That seems to me a sea change in recent years in terms of what the public feels should happen to those that are mentally retarded. I think there's a growing awareness of what mental retardation is and a growing understanding that since we don't execute children, why would we execute somebody that has the mind of a child?
Senator Edwards' bill has been held over in the Virginia House of Representatives pending the Supreme Court's decision. In the court today, the state of Virginia argued that even if there is a growing consensus against the death penalty for mentally retarded offenders, it could just be a temporary change in the popular mood. Lawyer Pamela Rumps said, quote, if Osama bin Laden were to come back tomorrow and he were found to be mentally retarded and brought to court, then public opinion would change. The Supreme Court is expected to rule on the case by summer. Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, the Supreme Court.
In other news at the nation's highest court, the starkest church-state conflict before the court in years sparked spirited debate among the justices. Today, the high court heard a challenge to Cleveland's school voucher program, which uses taxpayer money to subsidize private and religious education. Several justices say the program could pass constitutional muster if parents had a wide selection of choices beyond public and religious schools. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor is considered crucial in this case. She repeatedly asked whether quasi-public schools, such as charter schools, shouldn't be part of the mix. And Justice David Souter expressed concerns about the program and the fact that most of the kids use the vouchers to attend religious schools. In 2000, a federal appeals court declared the program unconstitutional. If the High Court reverses that decision, it will open the floodgates to further school privatization. John Hamilton reports.
In 1994, after the so-called Republican Revolution cemented the GOP firmly into power in the Ohio State Legislature, conservative groups began lobbying heavily to privatize the state's education system. The next year, they were rewarded when Cleveland became the first city in the nation to offer parents vouchers to send their children to private or religious schools. The program became the trial balloon for an education privatization movement that has yet to pass constitutional muster. And today, the Supreme Court heard arguments that could determine the future of school vouchers.
In this particular case, it is a clear-cut violation of the constitutional separation of church and state.
Janet Bass is a spokesperson for the American Federation of Teachers. She says that 99.4% of the money spent in Cleveland's voucher program is used to pay for religious education. But like her counterparts in Ohio's teachers' unions, Bass contends that the voucher program fails on more than a constitutional level.
The bigger issue is this program working? And it is not. Independent studies show that voucher students are not doing significantly better than their public school counterparts, and in some cases, they're doing worse.
Cleveland's voucher system has also borne the wrath of the city's school employees and teachers' unions, who argue that private and religious schools remain unaccountable even while receiving public subsidies. Michael Charney of the Cleveland Teachers Union questions his city's commitment to educating children with special needs.
If you look at the parochial schools who are participating, they don't have to take the kids with the severest disabilities. They can exit kids who misbehave, and they can practice massive employment discrimination on who they employ.
Perhaps the most influential advocates of school voucher programs are entrepreneurs like David Brennan of Ohio. In 1992, Brennan helped lay the groundwork for the state's voucher and charter school programs as part of a governor-appointed Blue Ribbon Commission on Education. Brennan is now CEO of White Hat Management Company, a for-profit corporation that operates 15 schools across Ohio. But the most visible pro-voucher organization is the Washington-based Black Alliance for Educational Options, or BAEO. The group advocates for vouchers, charter schools, and other aspects of the school choice movement. Virginia Walden Ford is on the Alliance's board of directors.
How long do we have to wait for public school systems to fix themselves? We need options now. We need to be able to educate our kids now and not lose this whole generation of children while we're waiting around for public education to make itself better.
Ford contends that her organization is a grassroots network of community activists, but BAEO has spent more than $5 million on television ads in the Washington, D.C. area, hoping to win congressional support for school vouchers. Tim Mooney, president of the Ohio Federation of Teachers, says that the Black Alliance for Educational Options is a front group for conservative interests.
There are some genuine grassroots people who are on the other side of this debate, and I respect any parent trying to find the best education for their kid. On the other hand, the so-called Black Alliance for Educational Options does not meet that definition. We know that they are funded by right-wing foundations, including the Bradley Foundation, which also funded the research, so-called research, for the book The Bell Curve, which tried to revive the, you know, centuries-old theory that, you know, certain ethnic groups are just inherently inferior.
While BAEO has won some support of minority groups in Cleveland and elsewhere in the country, African-American groups continue to remain split on the issue of school vouchers. The NAACP recently teamed up with the People for the American Way Foundation to argue against vouchers before the Supreme Court. The High Court is expected to hand down its decision by next summer. With the Workers' Independent News Service for Free Speech Radio News, I'm John Hamilton.
A coalition of labor, civil rights, and community activists rallied at airports across the West Coast yesterday. Their protests were part of a national campaign calling for the elimination of a new requirement that all baggage screeners be U.S. citizens. The mandate is part of the federalization of airport security. Yesterday was the first day that private security companies could legally begin to replace non-citizens. Max Pringle reports from Oakland.
Speaking under a tent near Terminal 2 at Oakland International Airport on this cold, wet afternoon, immigrant baggage screeners and their supporters called for fair treatment for all workers in this immigrant-dominated industry. Danilo Arsalo is from the Philippines and has been a baggage screener at Oakland Airport for 4 years. He says he fears for his job with the Huntley Private Security Company.
We are worried about our job because if we lose our job, what will happen to us? It's very hard to find another job in this Bay Area. That's why we are trying our very best to fight for this job, because we are here for almost 5 years to be a screener. We're just receiving before just $5 per day, and then per hour, and then afterwards we are receiving now after the September 11 we are receiving $11.50, and then they said we're gonna fire out for our job because of the September 11. That's not our fault.
Danilo is one of many immigrants fighting to keep their jobs in court. Last month, labor and immigrants' rights groups filed a class action lawsuit against the federal government's citizenship requirement. Airport security will be federalized on November 19th. Between now and then, some 20,000 non-U.S. citizens will be let go. Civil rights advocates say the irony is that legal residents will still be able to serve in the armed forces, purchase firearms, and handle packages at the post office. Koala Lunde is an organizer with Filipinos for Affirmative Action.
They really fear for their jobs because as immigrant workers, their checks go back home to pay for grandma's medicine, to put children through school. And if they know that making some noise about it might cost them their last two or three checks, that makes them very fearful because it's a survival and economic issue.
Give Marina her job back.
One such sacked worker is Marina Neri, a Filipino immigrant and four-year worker for Argenbright Security. She says she has a flawless work record, but was shown the door when she started a petition drive.
The security, the company Argenbright should not exercise or practice this favoritism and discrimination because it makes the workers not comfortable, and they do not have the capability to achieve the maximum capability to work hard if there is favoritism. That's what they felt now. Not only me, because a lot of them are telling me that, they feel that favoritism already.
Argenbright Security did not return Free Speech Radio News' calls requesting comment. Labor and immigrants' rights groups plan to organize committees among workers at the major Bay Area airports to deal with the workplace discrimination. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle in Oakland.
Last December, the FBI seized the assets of the Global Relief Foundation, which raises funds for humanitarian projects in 22 countries, including Afghanistan and Chechnya. Officials said at the time that they believed Global Relief could be funding terrorism, an allegation the charity flatly denies and for which the government has yet to provide proof. The same day, Immigration and Naturalization Service officials arrested Rabia Haddad, a co-founder of Global Relief and a respected local Muslim ecumenical leader, at his home in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Haddad, who was seeking status as a legal permanent resident, was charged with overstaying a tourist visa. Chris Giovannis of the Chicago Independent Media Center files this report.
Not in a million years I would have imagined this kind of pain and suffering would happen here. This kind of injustice would happen here on this land.
That's the voice of Salma al-Rashid, the wife of imprisoned Muslim ecumenical leader Rabia Haddad. For more than 2 months now, Salma has struggled with her husband's imprisonment and how to explain his absence to her children.
It's an everyday, 24-hour, every minute ordeal here in my house, you know, not being with my husband. Life without him is no life, you know. He has been really the soul of this house. But the part of having to explain his absence to my kids, that's the part that is so hard day after day, so hard.
In a highly unusual move, the INS court barred the press and public from Pastor Haddad's hearings, citing national security concerns, and then refused to set bond in his case despite testimony of his close community ties and his low flight risk, the two key criteria in INS bond decisions. In January, federal marshals took Haddad from detention in Michigan to Chicago's Metropolitan Correctional Center, where he remains in solitary confinement, though he has yet to be charged with a crime. Haddad's ongoing imprisonment has sparked a growing public outcry. Phyllis Engelberg of the Ann Arbor Ad Hoc Committee for Peace has been among those who have rallied to support Haddad and his family.
It's
caused a lot of fear and anxiety in the Muslim and Arab community here in Ann Arbor. People all over the country, though, have been outraged about this. There's been a tremendous outpouring of support. We still can't figure out what's going on, why Rabia and others around the country are being held without charge. We're wondering whatever happened to due process, speedy trials, and innocent until proven guilty.
Two congressmen, Lynn Rivers of Ann Arbor and John Conyers of Detroit, have spoken out about the Lebanese natives' imprisonment, and the Ann Arbor City Council and the Michigan Student Assembly passed resolutions supporting Haddad's right to a fair trial. In January, four Michigan newspapers, the Michigan ACLU and Congressman Conyers, who was denied entrance to Haddad's INS hearing, filed lawsuits to press the government to open proceedings to the media and public. Haddad has been subpoenaed by the U.S. Attorney's Office to appear before a secret grand jury in Chicago that has also questioned Global Relief employees about the group's possible ties to terrorism. But last week, federal officials said the government was not considering criminal charges against either the charity or Pastor Haddad. The question remains, why is Rabia Haddad still in custody? His attorney, Ashraf Nubani, can only speculate.
I think that the government is doing this for several reasons. One is an issue of how the administration wants to be viewed on dealing with immigrants, that we want to take a tough stand, and immigrants don't have the same rights that American citizens have, and therefore, even if we mistreat them, that's in the interests of the United States. I think also because of his organizational ties to Global Relief Foundation and the fact that the administration made a political decision to block the assets of this organization without due process. And now they're digging for information, whereas when they look at their records and their books, they see nothing but the organization doing humanitarian relief. And I think because of Pastor Haddad's relationship to the organization, he's also become a scapegoat because of that association.
Haddad supporters are more blunt, charging a double standard for immigrants on the one hand versus others accused of wrongdoing who have more clout or more status on the other. Andy Thayer of the Chicago Coalition Against War and Racism.
Here you have a man who has not been charged by the federal government. Indeed, the federal government has said it's not interested in criminally charging him, and yet he's held without bail in solitary confinement, 23-hour-a-day lockdown in a roach-infested cell. And yet at the same time, you have people of such high moral character as Kenneth Lay, able to walk the streets when there's plenty of evidence against people like him. And yet it's Arab Americans, Muslims, South Asians, like Rabia Haddad, who are held in these horrible conditions while crooks like Ken Lay run free.
Ann Arbor peace activists have a simple appeal. Phyllis Engelberg of the Ann Arbor Ad Hoc Committee for Peace.
Produce evidence that Mr. Haddad has been involved in some criminal wrongdoing or release him. At least let him out on bail. He's never been shown to be anything but faithful to his community and his family. He's not a flight risk. He's not a danger. Let the man go. They've had 2 months now to produce some evidence and have produced nothing. We're tired of the secrecy. We want to believe that we still live in a land where the Constitution is upheld.
Since his transfer to Chicago, the INS has effectively put Haddad's immigration case on hold. When or if Rabia Haddad will be released remains an open question. INS officials said they could not discuss an ongoing case, and when queried about Mr. Haddad, the U.S. Attorney's Office refused to comment. This is Chris Giovannis of the Chicago Independent Media Center for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Sputnik Kilambi in India. I report for Free Speech Radio News because it brings you the voices of the people and not just those who claim to speak in the name of their people. Free Speech Radio News only stays on the air with your financial support. Please make a donation to Free Speech Radio News online at www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org or call 510-287-5551. That's 510-287-5551.